This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal. And I want to focus on some very practical traffic-related stuff. Now, I was very happy this morning to read that Toronto is looking at licenses for e-bikes and e-scooters. We have often talked about how so many, I'm sad to say, of the people driving those things are really a menace to others. So from that point of view, it could be a good idea. But I have to say, whenever I see a proposal like this, my mind turns to the opportunity for more highly paid bureaucrats to administer it, which is maybe not exactly what we need. And speaking of bureaucrats, they apparently have now been handed over the responsibility for the Toronto Parking Authority. Olivia Chow fired the board in a very surprise move. I tried to get to the bottom of it. It's a very convoluted story. The mayor and Frances Nunziata say it's to save money. This, by the way, is the only money-making agency the city has. And there's some talk that they had some inappropriate walkabouts with a supplier. So I don't know. I hope the panel will be able to get into a little more of that. And I had a Neighborhood Residents Association meeting last night. And for years, it seems, we keep talking about a dangerous intersection, which is in a few feet of a traffic light. But for some bizarre reason, the traffic light is not at the intersection. Instead, there's just a little sign that says, please do not block the intersection. It's not clear. it's hard to tell if any driver is actually going to respect that. And it seems to be so hard to get the attention of the city councilor to focus on something like that, which is not an issue they can get a lot of publicity for. And likewise, here in Liberty Village, it is almost impossible to leave here at rush hour because all the left turns getting out of here are illegal. It was virtually impossible for a while. King and Dufferin was closed. You have to go all the way to Bathurst, and there was a turn. I don't even know what's going on with the pedestrian bridge at Duro Street. It was closed for a few months a long time ago, and they let you make a left turn instead of the right turn there. Now it's going to be, it has been closed for months and months, and will be closed for years. And I mean, I asked traffic services, well, why don't you let us leave some other way? And he said, you have to talk to your counselor. And really, you know, it is just not the kind of thing that holds Asma Malik's attention. So I'm trying to get some advice from our municipal panels. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740. Toll free, 1-866-744-740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome John Burnside, City Councillor for Ward 16, Don Valley East, and former Toronto City Councillors Rob Davis and Karen Stintz. And Karen has a new job, which involves some advocacy. So congrats, Karen. But tell us what you're doing.
Thanks, Libby. Yeah, I'm really excited to be part of a national organization called the Canadian Council on Rehabilitation and Work. It's, as I say, a national not-for-profit dedicated to helping people with disabilities find employment. And so working with employers and potential employees to find a match. and advocating for more accessibility in the workplace.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. Sounds like important work. Congratulations again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, moving along, Toronto looking at licenses for e-bikes and e-scooters. I get a lot of calls from people who say, why aren't these things or even bicycles licensed? And the answer in the past has always been because it would cost more to administer it than the city might collect. But is this, hopefully, is this a safety issue, John?
Well, it's a safety issue, but I would agree that the cost of actually administering it will be horrendous. Not to mention the fact that a lot of folks who are riding these things, giving them a fine is not really going to impact their lives. Some of them are so young, you know, they could be 12 or 14 year olds with these e-scooters, and you're not giving them a ticket for not having a license. So I think there's a lot of problems with that. The easier, I think, and more effective approach would be to give the police the power to seize these things. So they're illegal. If you're riding around on sidewalks, especially on sidewalks, then if the police had the power to seize them, I think a lot of people would stay off sidewalks.
Well, okay, so that's the e-scooters, but what about the e-bikes that we see a lot of delivery drivers use? And they also drive a lot on sidewalks if they think that the cars are taking too long. They're so many of them drive in a thoughtless and dangerous manner. Right turns from left lanes or driving right in front of moving cars. I mean, I'm sure, John, you're aware of it, but they don't seem to care. And I would imagine that if they got a fine, they would just ignore it.
Well, and that's the problem. If you don't have a driver's license, then a fine doesn't really impact your life. So yes, they're illegal, but I think, as I say, I think the thing we need to really attack is the safety, which, to your point, Libby, is whether it's an e-scooter or delivery with an e-bike, is the manner in which they're driving, especially on sidewalks and that type of behavior. And if the police had the ability to seize them, and if they knew if they got stopped by the police, they were going to lose their e-bike or their e-scooter, I think behavior would change pretty quickly. And we can deal with the other stuff potentially later, but let's get to the most serious problem first. And it's a pretty quick fix.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I didn't I'm on side with that, though. I'm sure there would be a lot of people saying, oh, you're going to take the e-bike away from the delivery driver. Rob, do you think that's something that has any kind of hope of happening?
Well, I think we can make a distinction between, you know, the commercial use of an e-bike versus the recreational use of an e-bike, just like we do with, you know, trucks and vans and Jeeps. You know, you're not allowed to park your commercial vehicle in a residential zone, essentially on your own driveway, because we distinguish between something that's used for, you know, taking your kids to school versus, you know, carrying plumbing equipment or carpentry equipment around. I think, you know, ironically enough, last Sunday, I had a hankering for some chicken wings. So I was walking to the local pub to get chicken wings, and there were three cops who had pulled over an e-bike rider, delivery guy, because he was riding in what I like to call now the Rob Davis bike lane, because I'm one of the only people who ever used the bike lane in West Bloor Street.
Trying to work off the chicken wings?
Trying to work off. But he got pulled over, and I recorded him. I'm going to post it on my Facebook page. People can watch it. But I said, what happened? Did they pull you over? And he just said, yeah. Now, three steps later, there's another police cruiser, and they are dusting for fingerprints because one of the shop owners had their store window broken, the window on their door broken into. Somebody had gone through and rifled through their cash register. So talk about sort of this weird mix of things happening. On one hand, you have this relatively minor infraction of an electric bike delivery guy driving at 11 o'clock at night on a very empty road, being pulled over. But for some reason, of course, because they got their alarm, there's police dusting for fingerprints. And it struck me as, you know, what is the priority that the community wants? On one hand, we do want people to be safe. We don't want these e-bikes on sidewalks. We don't want them on on bike lanes, because cyclists aren't going to be safe in the bike lane if you have e-bikes driving and zooming past them. But on the other hand, here's this family who are trying to eke out a living with their little restaurant being broken into, maybe because there weren't enough police in the neighborhood patrolling to act as a deterrent.
Well, I don't see e-bike riders. Police patrolling as a deterrent. I thought, great, the police were dealing with two things that we're happy they were dealing with. You go, guys. Karen, I mean, what do you think, and why is it so hard to get, you know, again, I talked to traffic services at the beginning of the week, and the answer was always, you have to talk to your counselor about that. My counselors don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, and I think part of it is raised is, you know, from John's point, Councillor Burnside's point, is that, you know, we've got this mess on our hands, and we don't have an elegant way to solve it. With respect to all the e-scooters and e-bikes that are taking over the roads and sidewalks and the bike lanes, because they're not legal. So the question is, how do you license something that's not legal to begin with?
Well, and so we looked it up, and apparently some e-bikes are legal if they fit the parameters or something.
Yeah, I think if it's under 30 kilometers and there's pedals on the e-bike, then it's considered a bicycle. But if it's over 30 and the pedals have been removed, then it's a different category. But if it's not legal, we can't license it. And again, we run into the problem that city doesn't issue licensing on vehicles, on any kind of vehicle. And if they don't have a driver's license and don't need a driver's license, then it becomes a bit of an exercise in futility. So, you know, if to John's point, if they were allowed to seize the illegal vehicles, then that would create some different behaviors, I would hope. But in the meantime, we have this situation where it's very dangerous for pedestrians and cyclists and drivers and the people that are riding these illegal e-scooters. And I don't have a simple solution, because it happens with the influx of the delivery of the Uber Eats and the Skip the Dishes. And it seems to me that we've created this subcategory of business entrepreneurs that, you know, don't actually really make a living. They don't drive legal vehicles, and they create unsafe circumstances for people. And it's, you know, where do you begin to tackle that problem? I don't have a good answer.
Does anybody, John, I think so far has the best solution, is seize the things. I cannot see that happening. There you go. And again, John, you know, what's your advice to a resident association member like myself? I mean, how do we get a city councilor to focus on something really basic, like why is the traffic light in the wrong place, or why are there no legal left turns at the end of the day in this neighborhood? Like, why can't we get them to focus on it? And what do you suggest?
Well, I think one of the problems is some councillors get a little bit ahead of themselves and become a little bit arrogant, and they forget that their bread and butter is actually dealing with the issues that you're talking about, the very basic issues that they can actually have an impact on that influence people's lives. And too many councillors see themselves as a lot more than that. But apart from that, the way you do it is in an election. And, there are a lot of unhappy people in your ward, and it's finding the right candidate, helping that candidate, whether it's knocking on doors or contributing to that candidate's campaign. And that's really the only way, I think, that anyone will change their behavior.
Okay, well, that's a long-term solution if I've ever heard one. Let's talk a little bit about this I found arcane and difficult to understand situation at the Toronto Parking Authority. Karen, what do you think is going on there?
It is curious, because the Parking Authority is, you know, they've had some hiccups in the past, no question, but it's a well-run organization that generates income and revenue to the city. And I don't understand what the city is trying to achieve. I suppose that they want to increase, the city's making the assumption that they could continue to generate the same amount of revenue, only it would come directly into city coffers and they could eliminate some duplication. But again, that's assuming that the bureaucrats will run it as effectively as the current organization does. And I don't know that that is a reasonable expectation. And it's just, there was no problem that needed to be solved by firing the board and bringing that in-house. And it's not even really clear how it's all going to happen and be managed. So I don't understand. And then I also find Councillor Nunziata's quote a bit odd in that she said there's nothing underhanded going on or something to that effect. Well, nobody suggested that there was. It just isn't a decision that made sense to anybody.
Well, I was reading about something that looked like it perhaps didn't look good, where the mayor and Francis Nunziata got a tour or a something from one of the suppliers to the parking authority. And maybe they're trying to cover up on that. I'm at a loss too. Rob, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, you know, I used to be in the investment business, and you only sell the dogs. You never sell the things that are making you a profit. You keep those in your portfolio. And it just seems to me that they're trying to make a change as if, you know, anybody can simply replace the board and anybody can replace the executives at the parking authority and run it at a profit. And then that's not always true. You can't just, you know, bureaucrats don't necessarily have the skill set that can replace the people who are responsible for making the profit. And over the years, the parking authority has consistently provided revenue to the city of Toronto. I suspect the thing that might be underhanded is that the parking authority holds a lot of land. They have a lot of surface lots that are potentially the future for, you know, future sites of housing or commercial developments. And that may be what's ultimately at play here. They don't always, as an independent board, they don't always bend at the whim of council, and they don't always bend at the whim of the mayor. And I suspect that that's the underlying issue. Huh. That they have a lot of land, they're making a lot of profit, and this is an opportunity to perhaps seize control of the land in order to pursue future development.
That's kind of interesting. You know, we had a couple of people. People, be patient. They want to talk about e-bikes. Sam has been hanging on to talk about that. Sam, go ahead. Hi, Sam. Sam, are you there? Okay. I don't know what's going on with Sam. What was he saying? They are dangerous. Yes, they are dangerous. People, if you want to call back, we do have a few minutes left. And as always, we want to hear from you. Some interesting or perhaps not interesting theories about what is going on with the firing of the board of the parking authority. And I always am skeptical about the ability of city bureaucrats to run something profitably. Just touching on provincial issues for a little bit. So yesterday, the new education legislation, which is giving the education minister more authority to step in when school boards aren't doing their jobs. A lot of, you know, breastfeeding by the opposition, by the unions, but apparently a school board up north, which triggered this, is where the trustees, like high school kids, are going to school in a half-demolished building, and the trustees, the school board trustees, are dragging their feet. So, is this what's your take, Karen? I mean, I think a lot of these school boards deserve to be taken over, but is this something that there is a genuine groundswell against?
I think you're right. I think that the school board trustees have outlived their usefulness, particularly because the province now funds education directly. At the time that the cities and towns and municipalities were responsible for funding education, those school board trustees made a lot of sense. But now that responsibility has gone to the province, and I don't see the value add that those trustees provide, because they have very limited scope of authority. They don't get paid a lot of money. And the other reality is that they're elected at the same time as councillors, But you only really care about your school board trustee if your kids are going through school. After that, you don't really care anymore. And so, you know, I think notionally people think trustees are important, but they don't really have a strong opinion. And personally, I think they're irrelevant because they don't add any value. And in fact, in some cases, they're making things a lot worse by trying to find relevance by passing crazy policies and doing loopy things. So I think that the government needs to be a bit bolder in this area and actually say, look, we fund the school boards, we create policy for the school boards, we ensure accountability for the school boards. So we don't need this extra layer of faux government governance.
Well, it certainly looks like that's where it's headed, John.
Yeah, and probably rightfully so. Look, they don't have enough power to actually improve things, but they have the ability to make things worse. And so I think that's a fundamental issue with trustees right now. But, you know, everyone's so concerned that there's about some sort of loss of democracy. The reality is, to Karen's point, the budget comes from Queen's Park. There's an education minister that decides largely about the curriculum and all those sorts of things. So an MPP could easily take on that role of being the conduit between the schools and parents. So I'm not sure what the big hullabaloo is really about. An MPP, the provincial member of parliament, has more than enough time to take on that responsibility. And it actually makes more sense because they're the ones that have influence over what's going on in the schools in terms of budget and curriculum anyway.
I'm not even totally understanding why the unions are so gung-ho on this, other than that they like to oppose the Ford government, Rob.
Well, listen, I think what's happened, and I think both Karen and Councillor Burnside have identified it, the role of trustees has slowly devolved and been devalued. When local taxation was, you know, when the taxation for school boards was removed from the tax bill, and when the province negotiates all of the collective agreements, and when the province has a universal curriculum and decides what the curriculum is, school trustees have less and less power. But they're elected by the public, and there's a high expectation by members of the public, but they have a very low legal requirement to provide any actual response or service. And I like to say this, like, you know, as a city councilor, you would often intervene sometimes in operational issues because you could. But as a school trustee, you're more like a trustee at a hospital, and you would never, having been both a trustee, a city councilor, and on a hospital board, you know, as a hospital board member, you would never in a million years question the functioning of a particular unit of the hospital. You would never, you know, intervene in the administrators, the doctors, the nurses, or any of the other important providers. But the public does expect you as a trustee to intervene on their behalf, but you don't necessarily have that authority. So a change is needed. The question is, what will the change be? What will it look like? And how will the existing complement of trustees be included in that decision?
I mentioned that Sam, we couldn't get Sam on the line, but he's called back, so we'll try to talk to him now. Hi, Sam. Go ahead.
Hi, Libby. Good afternoon. I make it short. I hope you guys are doing okay. I just want to say, basically, a lot of these kids I see on e-bikes and stuff, These folks, poor folks, I see them, young kids, you know, they're making a living, you know, they're making minimum wage living, tens of thousands of them, you know, and we shouldn't look at it from an elitist point of view. That's their lifestyle. You know what I'm saying? This job market and everything, I feel bad for them. And bicycle lobby in Toronto is very strong. Now they are kicking out e-bikes from their lanes. They're like 3% of the population who actually actively bike. And they have 50% of the roads without paying taxes, without paying road tax, license fee tax, parking ticket tax, traffic ticket tax, nothing. They feel entitled, and they want to kick these people to the regular road, which is already super congested.
Well, yes, but we're all on the regular road. I mean, you make a good point that bikes have bikes are very the bike lobby is powerful, but these young people should drive with a little more consideration. They don't care.
I agree. No, that's a very and, I agree 100%.
And there has to be a remedy. If they don't want to do so because they're nice, then I think John had a great idea. If you can seize their bike, maybe they'll behave a little bit better, Sam. But I mean, I hear you. Thanks for your call. And let's take one very quick one from Pat in Toronto. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Libby. Just the point that other than the fact that Toronto doesn't follow the rules, municipal politics is as close to democracy as you can come with no political parties. When I was doing this for 8 years, one of my constituents was Bill Davis, who pointed that out to me. And it means that you're not afraid to bring up issues that the mayor doesn't like. Whereas if you're in federal or provincial politics, you're either at the back of the room or you have to go across to the other side. So I think we really have to stick with what we've got as far as municipal politics is concerned. It is the best of democracy.
Yeah, but it's not working the way you said. Pat, thanks for your call. I'm looking at the clock. We are out of time, and people, Free for All Friday coming up tomorrow, so we can rehash these things then. In the meantime, thanks so much, Rob Davis, Karen Stintz, and John Burnside. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, Libby.
Okay, we're taking a break, and when we come back, we have a bunch of consumer stories, good and bad. The good news is that if you're getting to things like replacing an appliance before the holidays, they're rebates that look pretty healthy rebates to me. We also have a food sentiment index, and people are really still concerned and held back by the whole issue of food inflation, food affordability, even though I keep seeing things that are trying to tell me that food prices are going down. Well, they aren't. We'll talk about all of that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we've got good news and bad news for consumers. Now, first to the good, especially since many of us like to take care of things at home before the holidays. Ontario homeowners will soon be able to get provincial rebates of up to $200 for energy efficient appliances, that through an expanded program. That seems like a great idea. Now, if it's a vehicle you want to buy, well, the list of the most stolen cars is out, and maybe you want to avoid them. And topping the list, not unusually, is a 2024 Honda CR-V and the 2022 Dodge Ram 1500 series. So that's another thing to keep in mind. And the latest food sentiment index finds that food affordability and inflation remains the dominant concern. And this time it comes with a side of distrust in major food retailers who are always trying to tell us that they're giving us lower prices. So tell me what you think. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Ellen Roseman, who is a consumer advocate and journalist. Hi, Ellen. Ellen? Do we have Ellen? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Ellen. Okay, we've got you now.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So what do you make of this? I was like quite surprised, first of all, when I saw this new rebate program up to $200 for an energy efficient appliance. That looked really good to me.
Those kinds of things have been around for a long time because in general, people have a pretty good handle on how much they're spending on gas and electricity and so on during the winter months. And they don't want to upgrade their appliances unless they believe that there'll be some kind of a payback. So they're looking at that. And if the government can make it more attractive, then they'll probably get more of a take up. But in the past, I know because I was covering this way back, remember the federal government got involved with insulation for attics because oil prices were, you know, just not reliable. So they were offering amounts of money to people who got, usually it was some kind of styrofoam installation put into their attic or in their walls. And what happened was that the government was ready to pay the money, but the insulation industry all of a sudden just blew up and everybody was going door to door and trying to get into your home to put more insulation in there for you. And in Ontario, it got so bad and led to so many other types of things that were very similar, like with heat pumps and solar panels. And so the Ontario government took a while, but it eventually did crack down on all these door-to-door salespeople who really knew nothing about it except what they learned in a course they'd done the day before they rang your doorbell. But it still is useful to remind people that it's a good idea to change your appliances as they get older. And if you're just letting those old ones continue, you're probably using up a lot more energy within your house than you thought you were.
Yeah. Let's talk about the food before we get to some of the other stuff. So I shop around and it's very hard to make sense of it because what I usually find is that there's one product. It's a buck or two more expensive in one place, and then there in the other place where it's maybe cheaper, something else is more expensive. So it really is too difficult to try to get to it. But, you know, grocery stores are either trying to tell us it's the fault of tariffs, it may or may not be, or that they're keeping the line on prices. And I, for one, I'm with the people who distrust the big chains. I don't think they're on the up and up with this.
Yeah, I think in general there isn't a big level of trust, especially when it got really out of hand, the food inflation a few years ago. The government invited all the heads of the big chains to come and testify before a committee of parliamentarians. And many of them said afterward that they didn't even trust that the CEOs were giving them the information they were looking for, that they were always trying to make it look less, upsetting for the customer than it really was. And after that happened, I think the parliamentarian said they didn't want Galen Weston anymore, that they thought he was hiding things, like he didn't want to break down any of the statistics that come out with their financials. And now he's off somewhere else. He's not the CEO of the Loblaws chain anymore, and they've got someone new who seems to be doing a better job.
Well, yeah, and Pear Bank, they just released very good results, I might add, last week. And he was saying, well, there's more American products. And it's like, well, there are more American products because there's less choice of non-American products in the store. And especially when it comes to foodstuffs, for a while, we had all kinds of alternatives. And now there is a lot less of that.
Yeah, right. They're doing certain kinds of things like, what do they call it, the hit of the month, and they'll take something and cut it by 50%. I remember they started off with Kraft Dinner. And you could get six of them for $5 or something. So at least they're picking on the stuff that they know people eat a lot of. But then as soon as that special's over, then it goes back again. And they're also doing something that reminds me a lot of growing up and going grocery shopping with my mother. They're collecting, you have to collect little stamps and put them on a card. And when you get enough of them, they give you a free fry pan or free glasses. So they're trying to make it more fun, I guess, take people's mind off their anger that the prices don't stay.
And it's just like it's range. Another thing that's like, are you collecting? No, I'm not collecting stamps. It's enough that I have points. And I mean, who knows what? And I don't necessarily want the stuff that you get with the stamps. I mean, at the stage where, you know what, there's just too much stuff. And not enough place to put the stuff. So I have to be very judicious about what else that we allow into the house. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's we all have too much stuff. Let me take a call, quick call from Helen in Toronto. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Libby. I wanted to talk about the energy efficiency. Years ago, there was a program for seniors who had a fixed income that if your appliance wasn't energy efficient, the company would replace it. Well, this fellow came and he checked everything in the house, went downstairs to take a look at a Norwich fridge. Most people don't even know what it is. It was in the house when we bought it in 1961. He came upstairs and he looked white. And I said to him, what's the matter? He said, that fridge is as efficient as the fridge you have upstairs, which I'd only had since 96. There are no parts to it. There are no shelves. Everything was falling apart. But I could not believe, and he said, when we went back to the office and showed them the pictures and everything else, they said, well, you should have given her another one anyway, just for having one that old.
Okay. Thanks, Ellen, for that story. Ellen, so when should, I mean, I know that a lot of people who are sort of hanging on to stuff and they do want to replace them before the holidays, but, you know, what is a sign that really your appliances are not efficient enough, and how do you make that determination?
That's the hard part, because you have to know what is efficiency and how much of that your fridge or washing machine is living up to. In general, when appliances start getting older, you can see there's a lot of wear and tear, fridges in particular, because there's so many plastic shelves in there, and those plastic drawers, they all start getting broken or not, you know, sliding around very well. So sometimes just getting a new fridge, and maybe it could be the freezer on top, maybe, or a freezer down below, so you get more space for frozen food, and that can save you money because you're not always having to buy it right away. You can put it away for a while and eat it later.
Yeah, then you have to go through all the frozen stuff to find the one frozen thing that you're looking for. And then you realize, how long has this been in there for?
That's right.
I'm sorry to be a naysayer about that. Yeah.
I think in general, many of us are just changing our food habits. Like I used to always think dinner was meat or fish plus vegetables plus, a carb like potatoes or rice or whatever. But now I'm just doing a lot more of like a good soup at the beginning and maybe some sandwiches or salads or whatever, and just bringing down the level of effort, I guess, it takes and cost to have a really good dinner on the table every night.
Well, we're still at your first thing. So, and I don't mind doing it, but it's getting more and more expensive. And last week we were talking to Sylvain Charlebois, and I was saying, well, one of the things I bought some steak at, I guess it was a Metro, and it was on sale. It was not cheap. It was like boneless rib steak, which is normally a very expensive cut. And it was, you know, maybe I would say 30% less than usual. And then I cooked it, and it was tough. And the husband was not happy. Like he was saying, we can afford a decent steak if we're having steak. And it's like, Sylvain said, it's probably a lower grade of beef from Mexico, and they don't tell you that.
And you would think there might be some warning about, you know, the expiry date or something.
Well,
eat it tonight.
No, the expiry date wasn't an issue, but you know, some of it, you know, when they would tell you, imported from Mexico, grade B, not grade AAA. So, no warning. So I think that contributes to people feeling a little bit mistrustful of the big grocery stores.
Yeah, exactly. And they have to at least try and create some excitement about certain of the products that they have. And without that, it becomes even more depressing to go shopping without any good specials on that day when you're there.
Just before we wrap things up, just a very quick look at the list of the most stolen cars. So it's a 2024 Honda CR-V, 2022 Dodge Ram 1500 Series, 2019 Honda Civic, and the top of the pack are the Lexus TX Series. Now, if you go for one of these cars, are you going to pay more insurance? Is that right?
Well, I remember the days when the Insurance Bureau of Canada, which I think was only an Ontario organization, would make a big fuss and tell people if they were buying a car, they should consult the list of the most stolen cars. And it was available, I think, on some website, maybe it was their own website. And they were just saying that if you did buy, if you stayed away from the most stolen cars, you would probably not have to worry about having to pay a higher rate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming they're the most stolen cars because the people who buy stolen cars want them.
Yeah, and also, I drive a Toyota. This is my second one, so I'm up to about 25 years. And I find it's very reliable. It's, I have a great dealer. I have to have things done occasionally, but it's not the kind that falls apart that quickly. And when we are out of town and take an Uber, we find that nearly all the drivers are driving Toyotas of different kinds.
Okay, well, good car's a good car. Ellen Roseman, great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, Libby. Great to talk to you, too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
We're taking another break, and wow, that really explosive story about a Canadian fugitive who is accused of being a drug kingpin protected by the Sinaloa cartel. We had the head of the FBI, Kash Patel, raising the reward for this ex-Olympian. Remember, Ryan Wedding, and now his lawyer is accused and arrested for allegedly telling him to get a witness killed. So, it's quite the story, and we will be talking to Joseph Neuberger when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we turn now to shocking new developments in the case against the Canadian at the center of a huge international drug investigation. The U.S. Department of Justice says Canadian ex-Olympic snowboarder who has turned into an alleged drug trafficking kingpin, Ryan Wedding, ordered the January murder of a key witness in the case against him. And they also allege that he did this on the advice of his Greater Toronto Area lawyer. And now the lawyer, Deepak Balwant Paradkar, Deepak Balwant Paradkar has been arrested. So I think this is really quite unusual. The number's 416-360-0740. Toll-free, 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Joseph Neuberger, criminal defense lawyer with Neuberger and Partners LLP. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Now, how unusual is this for a defense lawyer to be arrested?
It's very unusual, especially in Canada. You know, there's definitely a code of conduct that we all adhere to, and we defend our clients within the bounds of the law. So this type of a set of allegations is very concerning and disturbing to the entire bar.
Okay, so now this lawyer is a guy who was known as a kind of very flashy, brash guy. You know him, correct?
Yeah, I way back when he articled, I was at the same law firm with him, and very bright. At that time, he wanted to go into health law, a very bright guy. Went into criminal law, much like I did, and I've seen him over the decades. I mean, I think he's been practicing for the same period I have, about 33 years.
Right. So you know him quite well if you article together, yes?
I do. Yeah. No, I know him. I've seen him in the courts. I've been in Brampton tons of time, so I know Deepak very, very well.
And what was your reaction when you heard he'd been arrested like this?
Shocked, very shocked. I mean, I know the his practice has a lot of drug cases. Many of us who practice criminal law at one time or another would do a lot of drug work. My practice has changed over time, but we all do that type of work, and you always have to be very careful that you're not wading into areas where you shouldn't, given your ethical obligations. I was quite shocked because I've known him to be a good lawyer, and this is really quite shocking.
Okay, so has there been any kind of disclosure? Do we know, do we have a sense of what the evidence against him is?
No, so what happens now is he's been arrested by the RCMP. So what that means is there's an extradition warrant that was issued in Canada for his arrest. That's now been executed. So he's in custody now awaiting an extradition bail. So I assume he'll apply for bail. And then an extradition hearing will have to happen in Canada. And what happens with extradition is the Federal Department of Justice will receive a package from the United States, which will be sort of disclosure. It's not the same you'd get in a criminal case in Canada. It's a summary of the case. And so you will get enough details that a court on a hearing would be able to determine that these are offenses that would be offenses in Canada. And there's sufficient evidence to have him committed. So it's a very low threshold. Generally, you can't fight extradition. I mean, I used to do a lot of extradition work. It was like banging my head against the wall. I mean, you might as well just work out a deal with the United States to go down on extradition. Fighting it out is very hard.
I would imagine that they would have to have some very high bar of evidence, like a wiretap. Is that what you would imagine? Or they're just like, we may as well let's extradite this guy since the bar is low.
Yeah, so you raise an excellent question. So I would imagine that there would be some credible evidence. Wiretaps certainly would be one of those. Intercepts of any other types of communications. I'm not sure if they were communicating over secure platforms where it's encrypted. So I would assume that there's, certainly wiretap evidence and maybe messages. And I'm certain the United States, they always like to have their informants and people who sort of turn on other accused individuals to make deals in the United States because of their sentencing regime there. So I would hope there's some of that type of evidence. I'm one who's always a little concerned with U.S. cases because not all the time do you have the best evidence. Sometimes you're just relying on human sources for information. And of course, people have motivations to lie and to make up evidence in order to get a deal, which is less than what they normally would be facing. So I think the extradition package, which his lawyer will receive here, will have a fair amount of information, and that will give some insight as to exactly what evidence they have in the United States.
Is the context, we've been hearing all this stuff that the Trump administration is doing, allegedly to get drug dealers, it's not on their territory. They're shooting. Seems to be kind of the Wild West. Do you think that this is a part of that?
Well, I'm not sure if that was on President Trump's radar, but I can tell you, after 33 years of practice and having done some large drug cases, I was on two of the most well-known drug cases in Canada involving two very large players. This is nothing new. I mean, arresting a lawyer is very novel. That doesn't happen often. But there's a lot of interjurisdictional investigations that go on because drug cases span borders, United States, Canada, Mexico, and other regions, at that time, Italy. So it's not uncommon. When he says about the flow of fentanyl, it's a fairly low amount that flows from here to there, but there's always multi-jurisdictional criminal organizations. I mean, they don't just operate within boundaries. Larger ones operate internationally.
To the actual alleged criminal. Ryan Wedding, I mean, they described him as a modern day Pablo Escobar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, you get a more of a sensational type of headline in the United States about this stuff, and he's on, I guess, the 10 most wanted. They must have a lot of evidence about him. So he's, from their perspective, he's a very, very large drug trafficker. But there's a lot of very powerful cartels at play with massive drug dealing across our globe, and you know, he may be just one of those players. Whether he's as large as they allege, time will only tell once the case, you know, unfolds in the United States.
We started the conversation. You were talking about how this is of concern to the entire Canadian bar. Would you say that his fellow lawyers are rallying? I mean, what's your take on that aspect of it?
No, I mean, you know, as a lawyer, we like to have. You know, not only to provide high quality services to our clients, but to have a high degree of integrity in line with our obligations. And that's something that I've always been very proud of in Canada. We have a lot of just the criminal bar alone. We have an excellent criminal bar in Ontario, and people are extremely integrous. Many defense lawyers go on to have distinguished careers as judges. So this is something, I mean, I've spoken to a number of lawyers because we all know Deepak. And it's concerning. I mean, we like to protect the integrity of our profession. It's very important that we are listened to, especially on matters of policy. When it comes to criminal law, I certainly speak out on issues. And I think in order to have the ability to speak out on issues and be a functional part of what is a key part of our democracy, you have to have integrity. And so this strikes to the heart of that. So if these allegations are true, you know, he's presumed innocent, then it's very concerning to all of us because we don't like to see one of our fellow criminal lawyers wrapped up in something that's criminal in nature.
Wow. Okay. And just very quickly, what's next?
So next will be a bail hearing. If he's granted bail, he'll be really strict. Then he'll head down the line for an extradition hearing. That's based on a statement of the case, as I mentioned, provided by the U.S. If he's ordered extradited, then he can appeal to the Court of Appeal after the minister. So it's a complicated process, but once he's ordered extradited, it goes to the minister to make the formal order of extradition, and then you can appeal both the hearing and the minister's order to the Ontario Court of Appeal. And if you wanted, you could appeal all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada. I guess issues are what sort of penalty he'd face in the United States. It's California, I think, so I don't think he'd be facing anything other than jail time. That's always a concern if the death penalty's involved, and I don't think it would be in this case at all. But eventually he will be extradited. It's extremely difficult to fight extradition unless there is very, very minimal evidence tying him to these offenses. So it's going to unfold fairly quickly over the next several months to a year.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Joseph Neuberger, and I'm sure we will be returning to you as this case unfolds. Appreciate your time very much.
Happy to assist. Thanks for having me on, Libby.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
People, that's all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. Free for All Friday coming up tomorrow. So feel free to call on Free for All Friday. Meantime, follow us on Instagram, follow us on YouTube, and I'll be back in the chair tomorrow.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.